Good morning, church. Okay, it got cold. There's generally two types of people. People that are ready for it to happen, it's about time, and then others that are sad because they want the warm weather to stay for month after month. So who says you kind of wish it would stay warm for a little while longer? You're kind of sad right now. And who's like, let's go, it's time. Okay. Split room on that one. Well, it's funny that it got cold today because I was going over my sermon this weekend. And so we're hopping into suffering today. And I think God knew that, and he turned the weather cold for that reason. So if you've not been with us this year, we are going through the theme, Believe in Me. It's that banner on your right. And so we've been talking a lot about faith, a lot about belief. Earlier in the year, we went through a lot of messages about the relationship between faith and science. We talked about the crisis of meaning, the nature of doubt. We did a deep dive into AI even, so all sorts of things about faith. And so today we begin a conversation about one of the most important questions concerning faith, which is the classic question. How could a God that we claim is really good and we sing about as really good, how could he allow such really, really bad things to happen? It is a question that has haunted many, many people for many, many years. In fact, in the Holocaust, there was a man named Elie Wiesel, and he survived the Holocaust, but his faith did not. He said this, "Never shall I forget those flames which consumed my faith forever. Never shall I forget those moments which murdered my God and my soul." So for him, he could not reconcile the good God above him and the visceral evil before him. At the same time, a woman named Corrie Ten Boom also survived the Holocaust, and she had a very different response. She sat in a dark concentration camp for a long time with her sister. Her sister eventually starved to death, and later, Corrie Ten Boom wrote this, "I remember on one occasion when I was very discouraged there. Everything around us was dark. I remember telling Betsy that I thought God had forgotten us. No, Corrie, she said, he's not forgotten us. Remember his word. For as the heavens are high above the earth, so great is his steadfast love towards those who fear him." And then this is Corrie again talking. This is a beautiful line. She says, "There is an ocean of God's love available. There is plenty for everyone. God is good when he sends weather, but God was also good when he allowed my sister Betsy to starve to death." So you've got two different people there, and they experience the same horrific tragedy, and their faiths go into totally different directions. Why is that? What's the difference? You can think about the disciples in the aftermath of the crucifixion. Most of them show up to the upper room, but Thomas does not. They all see the same thing, and yet they react completely differently. So here's some kind of depressing stats. Every day on planet Earth, 150,000 people pass away. Now, a lot of those are older people in hospitals, surrounded by people they love. But a lot of them are not. A lot of that number is just senseless, tragic. They didn't see it coming, and it created this ripple effect of grief for all of their loved ones. In the U.S. today, 2,000 people will get divorced, 5,000 people will be diagnosed with cancer, 16,000 people will get in a car wreck. And we handle it differently. I think about what's going on in this room. There's so many of you that what's happening in your life right now, you would have never guessed that a year ago. You didn't know then about the cancer now. You didn't know that the relationship would go downhill. You didn't know that you'd go through a stillbirth. You didn't know that you would lose that person that you loved. And so now you're sitting here, you're in church, and you're thinking, I'm trying to hold it together, but it's really hard. Some people go through suffering and it brings them closer to God. Other people go through suffering and it pushes them away from God. And I am interested to know what's the difference. A lot of it does have to do with how we reconcile this big question: how does a good God allow pain and suffering in the world? Today, I'd like to share with you three realities about suffering that can be helpful to us as we walk through this. And I want to be sensitive here. For some of you, you're not suffering right now, so this will just be a nice, pleasant philosophical and theological exercise. But for others of you, you're going through it right now. And so this might be, like, I might be saying things and it just is a total disconnect from the visceral, raw emotions that you're feeling at this time. This could be one of those messages in that light that you have to come back to maybe months later and listen to again. So here's three realities about suffering. The first one is this: suffering is not just a Christian problem. It's a human problem. So this argument against God is often talked about in Christian circles. How could your loving God allow this evil to exist in the world? But the reality is, every belief system, every ideology, every worldview has to come up with some framework and response to suffering. So it's not just that Christians have this problem. Everybody has this problem. So Eastern traditions have their response to pain and suffering. For example, in Buddhism, all suffering comes from desire. So if you just eliminate desire, then you take care of suffering. Or the Stoics, they have a really interesting framework and response to suffering. So for a Stoic, suffering just comes from love. And so you just need to stop loving. In fact, here's this. This is a quote, I think it's from the second or third century Stoic. When you kiss your child or brother or your friend, never give way entirely to your affections, but curb it, restrain it. So that's one way, one worldview of how you handle suffering. But on and on it goes. There's the Muslim framework for suffering. There's even an agnostic and an atheist framework for pain and suffering. And so if you're a Christian and you're wrestling with what's going on in your life or the life of someone you know, and you have this impulse to walk away, I don't know if I can take it anymore. I don't know if I can keep worshiping this God. I just don't know. I'm thinking about walking away. Before you do that, just know that when you walk away from faith, your suffering goes with you. Like it stays with you. So this is not just a Christian problem. This is a human problem. Here's reality number two. Ancient Christians held a different view of their suffering, or at least they suffered differently. And I don't mean that different things happened to them. That could be also the case, and that is the case. I'm talking about early Christians suffered differently inside. How they handled it was in many ways better than how many of us handle it today. Tim Keller wrote a book before he died about pain and suffering. And in one of his chapters, he does a history of Christian suffering. It's a fascinating chapter. And so what he talks about is, well, first of all, this argument of suffering being used as evidence for the non-existence of God, that is very modern. No Christian in the ancient world used that as an argument against God. And the irony is, Christians in the ancient world in many ways suffered more than we do today. So 1 out of 5 kids died before the age of 1. 50% of children didn't make it to age 10. Christians in the ancient world had to live through plagues, which at that time wiped out 1/3 of the empire. And so they are living through extremely difficult times. And yet, according to ancient diaries and journals, which we have of many different people of many different worldviews, guess which group of people suffered with the most grace, the most dignity, the most courage? It was the Christians. In fact, here's another ancient quote. It's from a guy named Cyprian in the 2nd century. He said, he's actually surveying how different people are handling suffering. And he says this: Christians used suffering to argue for the superiority of their creed because they suffered better than the pagans. And so in our day, suffering becomes this argument against God, or it becomes a threat to faith. But in the ancient world, suffering was a badge of honor. Like we're proud to walk together with our suffering Jesus Christ, knowing that it's not the end, because the way that we suffer is this incredible witness to the wider world. So ancient Christians suffered really, really well. And so then the question becomes, well, what happened? When did that change? When did Christians go from being resilient to being fragile? And when did suffering go from this badge of honor that we walk in suffering with Christ to then this argument that we would levy against the very existence of God himself? Well, again, to go to Keller in his book, he has a fascinating theory. He thinks everything changed on November 1st, 1755 in Lisbon, Portugal. On that day, there was a massive earthquake, and it leveled the city. There was an ensuing tsunami, which did more damage. And at the end of the day, there was 40,000 people who died. Obviously, there was immense grief, incalculable emotional reaction and loss. There was a lot of anger towards God. However, at this time, though, there was a different tenor in the reaction. Really, for the first time, it wasn't just we're mad at God, it was we're not even sure if God's there. So here's a quote from a philosopher at the time, famous guy named Voltaire. He wrote a long poem about his own grief in reaction to this tragedy, and here's a few lines from that poem. He said, "A God once dwelt on earth amongst mankind." So notice he's saying the implication is God's not even here anymore. Or then this other line from the poem, "Ill could not from a perfect being spring." So like this can't come from God. You can't look at the wake of this rubble and conclude that there actually is a God. So this is different. Not just angry at God, but he's arguing that perhaps the magnitude of this event is evidence that God actually does not exist. So there's been tragedies before the Lisbon earthquake, but people didn't react this way. And so, what's up with 1755? Like, why would people react differently in this particular century than other centuries? So if you know anything about world history, what's going on in the world in the middle of the 18th century? The Enlightenment is happening. The Enlightenment was this incredibly world-altering move in which all these brilliant thinkers and philosophers and scientists got together over the course of the 18th century, and they pioneered a new way of thinking about the entire world. And this way of thinking went something like this: we will now solve problems not with religion, but with reason and with science and with logic. And so we will tackle every problem systematically, logically, until we eradicate that problem. And so this worldview of the Enlightenment had all sorts of implications for other parts of life. So what do we do with God now? Well, God is useful only in the sense that he helps us with the new God of progress, because we just want the world to keep moving forward and we want to solve things with progress. And so this all leads to the third truth about suffering. Modern views of suffering have been heavily influenced by the Enlightenment. And so, how does the Enlightenment shape the world's view of suffering? In three ways. Number one, get it out of sight. So let's put cemeteries at the edges of town. Let's outsource the dying to the hospitals. Let's mask our pain with medicine. Let's just get suffering out of sight. Number two, in the Enlightenment, suffering began to be used as something to attack God. So if we're going to be logical about everything, if we're going to be evidence-based, then like Voltaire, suffering becomes exhibit A for God's non-existence. So get suffering out of sight, use it to attack God, and then number three, beat suffering with technology. Just get the next medicine approved, just develop the next surgery technique, just invent psychotherapy, or here's a new nutritional plan that's going to solve this problem or that problem. So suffering became simply a project, a problem to be tackled and eradicated and solved. And so it's amazing because on the one hand, the Enlightenment brought us pretty incredible things. Modern medicine, modern democracy. In fact, much of Western civilization derives from the Enlightenment. However, when it comes to its view of pain and suffering, it set us back. You think you've been shaped by the Enlightenment? See, we assume that our relationship to suffering is universal, like all people at all times have related to suffering the way that we as modern Western people relate to suffering, but that's just not true. In fact, this is so interesting to me. So Paul Brand is a physician that spent most of his career treating leprosy patients across the world, and he's actually partnered with Philip Yancey in a lot of his projects. But one of the things that Dr. Brand said, so he'd been traveling treating leprosy patients in Africa. He came back to the U.S., and he was just shocked at the difference of how people handled suffering in the U.S. versus other parts of the world. So here's what he said. In the U.S., I encountered a society that seeks to avoid pain at all costs. Patients lived at a greater comfort level than any I had previously treated, but they seemed far less equipped to handle suffering and far more traumatized by it. Isn't that interesting? So because he's able to look at other cultures, he's able to see clearly this central truth. Modern society has made us experts in luxury, but novices at suffering. We're just not good at it the way that ancient people used to be good at it. Here's another example of the cultural conditioning of our suffering. So the DSM is this acronym which stands for the Diagnostic Manual for Mental Disorders. It's been extremely helpful in the realm of psychology for many, many decades. It goes through revisions every few years. Well, one guy named Robert Spitzer, he gave much of his life to an early edition of that book. 25 years later, he was asked about how he felt about all these disorders that he had helped catalog. And he said, I actually have a lot of regrets. And so he was asked, well, why do you have all these regrets? And what he said is that he believed he had wrongly labeled many normal experiences of grief as mental disorders. And so here's a direct quote from Spitzer. He says, we assumed that he or she, talking about normal patients, we assumed that he or she was suffering from a disorder that needed to be cured rather than from a natural and normal human reaction to certain life conditions. In other words, he believed that he had inadvertently reframed normal grief as a condition to be eradicated rather than as a normal part of human life to be endured. And so why would he do that? Well, it's because he, like so many people, have been shaped by the Enlightenment. Just fix it, solve it, eradicate it, remove it from sight. So summarizing all these truths, here it is. Why is there such a strong reaction today against God in the face of suffering? To put it bluntly, it is because suffering has been hijacked by Western culture. Our impulse to fix suffering, to explain suffering, to master suffering, to eradicate suffering, has more to do with us being Western than us being Christian. So look very carefully at how suffering comes to us within our own faith tradition, in the very language of inspiration found on the pages of Scripture. And especially if you're in the middle of suffering right now, just let the weight of these words wash over you. I'm just going to read 6, 7, 8 verses from the Bible about suffering. Isaiah 53, he was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering, familiar with pain. Hebrews 5, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him. 2 Corinthians 1, for just as we share abundantly in the sufferings of Christ, so also our comfort abounds through Christ. Philippians 1, for it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ, not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for him. Philippians 3, I want to know Christ, Yes, to know the power of his resurrection and the participation in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death. 2 Timothy 2, join with me in suffering like a good soldier of Christ Jesus. 1 Peter 2, Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. How often have you read passages like these and just plowed ahead, ignoring the weight of these words? You know what's really easy to do with these passages? It's to assume that they're written for somebody else. Oh yeah, that made sense in their time. People really suffered back then. I mean, people were really poor back then, and they were persecuted back then. But, you know, whew, at least we live in the 21st century where suffering really isn't a part of our world, so we don't need those passages. I mean, do you realize how crazy that sounds? If we don't pay attention to these verses, there is a word for that. Denial. Suffering is much as a part of our world as it was in their world, even if we try to push it away. So here's the good news. If we step back from denial, if we open our eyes, if we can work backwards beyond this Western bias that's been created the last 200 years, and we just look at the Christian faith, like not as something that we would use like to attack God, if we just look at the Christian faith just to consider what it offers, then what we conclude is this: the Christian worldview is the most robust belief system for suffering in the whole world. The Christian worldview doesn't say suck it up like the Stoics do. It doesn't say, well, eliminate all desire like a lot of Eastern faiths do. And it does not say fix it as quickly as possible like Western modern humanists. Here's what the Christian worldview says about suffering. Weep with the weeping God, knowing that the weeping is not the end. Weep with the weeping God, knowing that the weeping's not the end. So first, weep. Look at the Psalms. Embrace the emotions that you feel. Don't repress it. Like it's okay. It's normal. It's a good thing to let the tears flow. But also notice this second part of this idea. Weep with the weeping God. There's a scene where Jesus walks up on Jerusalem in Luke 19, and he's looking out at the city that's about to partner with the powers of darkness and put him on trial and murder him, and he cries. He knows what's about to happen. He knows the nails that are about to pierce his hands and feet. He knows that his own mother is going to be at the foot of the cross weeping. And how does Jesus respond to this imminent pain and suffering about to come on him? He just lets the tears flow. When was the last time you cried? I actually cried a little bit yesterday. So my dad celebrated his 70th birthday this weekend. And one of the things that he wanted to do was he wanted to gather the grandkids around and he wanted to sing them the song that Tim McGraw wrote, Always Be Humble and Kind. And in his preamble, before he sang that song to the grandkids, he just told them, hey, in case I forget to tell you what I really think matters in life, I want to sing you this song. It was really meaningful and deep, and I just couldn't help it. I cried. The most raw tears that I encounter from people are usually at funerals, when most of the people have already exited the room, but the family comes down front to say their final goodbyes. Those tears are hard. They're raw. They're uncontrollable. They're real. When was the last time that you cried? It's odd, in our point in history, many people think they need to stop crying. All right, gotta be tough. Stop the tears. Let this truth sink in. Jesus didn't stop his own tears. He let them flow. And as he's looking out on this city that's about to take his own life, Jesus is weeping not just for that context and not just that city. He's weeping for all of broken humanity. His tears are becoming this river of tears for everyone that he loves who has grieved. And so he's weeping over all of it, over every earthquake and every school shooting and every tsunami, every stillbirth, every child that's hid in the back of a closet scared because their father has come home drunk again, every person that's walked up on a car wreck praying that they're not going to see the worst. He's weeping for all of us. And so what this means is that every time you cry, every tear on your face has a twin on the face of God. We weep with God. Here's the third part of that phrase. So we weep with a weeping God, knowing, here's the third part, the weeping's not the end. And this is the great promise. The tears are not the final chapter. Jesus' victory over death becomes our victory over death. His resurrection becomes our resurrection. His reunion becomes our reunion. So yes, suffering is strong, but it breaks under the weight of the glory of God. You see, modern people, this is really important, dial in. Modern people cling desperately to happiness now, knowing that on the horizon is inevitable sorrow. But Jesus embraces suffering now, knowing that on the horizon is unshakable joy. So here's one final point of contrast as we consider which worldview to give our suffering to. So if your faith is low and you're thinking about walking away because of what has happened to you or someone you love, please listen to this. One of the most influential voices in shaping the modern humanist atheist worldview was philosopher and atheist Friedrich Nietzsche. In 1883, a volcano exploded near the Indian Ocean, destroying several cities and killing thousands. Now, Nietzsche had fully embraced a world without God, and thus he wrote to a friend from that worldview about this tragedy. And here's what he wrote. 200,000 wiped out at a stroke. How magnificent. You see, this is the kind of reaction you would expect to come from someone who does not believe that there is a God. Because if there's no God, there's no sanctity of life. There's no reason to get upset in the first place. If 200,000 people are wiped away from an economic standpoint, great, less of them, more for us. So our outcry as Christians against suffering is ironically one of the greatest evidences that there actually is a God. Like, why else would we react this way unless we're created in the image of a God who loves people? So we will suffer, but we do have a choice as to how we suffer. Like, suffering is inevitable. No one can prevent it, but your beliefs have immense impact in the manner of your suffering. The worldview that you choose will have great weight when it comes to how you suffer. And so if you can choose to suffer the Christian way, then here's what's in that repository. Here's the resources that you get if you suffer as a Christian. If you can work backwards through the Western bias in the modern world, here's what you're going to find in this deep reservoir of Christianity. You're going to find testimonies of the faithful. You're going to find witnesses of the martyrs. You're going to find wisdom of the wounded. You're going to find the tears of God, the scars of Jesus, and the hope of heaven. It's a pretty good place to start. And this morning, you're going to find the body of Christ. So we're going to sing a song about the people of God rising above the storm. And so if you're in the middle of one of those storms right now and you need someone to know about it, our shepherds are going to be in the back two atriums and they'd love to sit with you for a little bit, listen to you and pray with you. So I invite you to go to the back if that is something you'd want to take advantage of this morning. And if you'd like to give your life to Jesus in the waters of baptism, I'll be down front to receive you. Let's stand and sing.